Have you ever just felt completely overwhelmed by how highly organized everything is right now, but also how careless it all feels?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you look around the modern world and it's terrifyingly perfect in a way. You tap a piece of glass in your pocket right now.
Right, your phone.
Yeah, your phone. And suddenly these complex algorithms are talking to global supply chains and robotic warehouses and cargo
All
ships.
perfectly synced up.
Exactly. And then a package just magically arrives at your door in under 48 hours. It's a genuine miracle of human coordination.
It really is, yeah.
But then, despite being literally embedded in all of this seamless coordination, so many of us feel, I mean, we feel chronically stressed out or isolated or even physically sick.
Yeah. Well, that's the ultimate modern paradox, isn't it? We've built these highly effective systems of logistics and control, but they feel fundamentally misaligned with actual human well-being. We've
Right.
basically achieved this state of coordination without care.
Coordination without care. That tension, that exact gap between a highly functioning system and a healthy human being is the entire foundation of our journey today.
That's a big journey, too.
Oh, it's massive. We are doing a deep dive into a really dense, fascinating 2026 white paper. It's by Dr. Bechara Saheeli, and it was created using some AI-assisted synthesis.
Right.
It's titled The Biology of Love as the Grammar of Life Coherence. And I gotta say, our mission today is basically to build a conceptual ladder.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, we're gonna start way down at the microscopic level, like a single living cell. And then step by step, we're gonna climb all the way up to global planetary governance.
Which sounds impossible, but
Right, but we wanna understand what it actually means for a system to be life coherent.
yeah, and the ambition of this paper is just staggering, but what's really fascinating is that it gives us a remarkably consistent biological framework to make that entire climb.
Okay, so where do we start?
Well, the central argument is that if we actually want to understand why our global society is failing the biosphere and how it could succeed, we have to radically shift our perspective.
Like, shift away from what?
Away from our total obsession with, machine-like efficiency and control, we have to move toward a framework rooted in what the author calls the biology of love.
Okay, wait. I know that phrase, the biology of love, might sound to you, the listener, like, I don't know, a self-help paperback you'd buy at an airport.
Yeah, it sounds a bit sentimental at first.
Exactly. But in the context of this paper, it's rigidly scientific, it's structural, it's literally a biological mechanism.
Concretely.
And honestly, grasping this concept is kind of the ultimate shortcut to understanding health, education, and basically the survival of our civilization.
But to get there, we really can't start by analyzing politics or economics, you know?
Because if we do, we just bring all our human baggage into it, right?
Exactly. If you start with human society, you're just projecting your own biases and your own ego onto the problem.
So we have to strip all of that away. We have to go down to the absolute baseline of what living actually is, far below human language or politics.
Right. We have to start with the microbe.
Down to the single cell.
Yeah. So to do that, the paper begins with this really foundational concept from theoretical biology. It's called molecular autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis. Okay, that is a very heavy academic word. Let's unpack that immediately so we don't lose anyone in the jargon.
Fair enough. So it comes from Greek, auto, meaning self, and poiesis, meaning creation or production, like the word poetry,
Yeah,
right?
self-creation.
Exactly, self-creation. In biology, a living system is fundamentally different from a machine. Think about a car, right?
Okay.
A car is an example of allopoiesis or other creation. It's built by external creators, factory workers, robots who assemble parts that were manufactured somewhere else.
Right, the car isn't building itself.
Exactly. But a living system is a discrete unity that continuously produces the very molecular components that make up its own boundaries. It literally makes itself from the inside out constantly.
Okay, so I was trying to visualize this when reading the source, and I kept picturing like a submarine navigating through the deep ocean.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
But it's not a normal machine. Imagine the submarine is constantly rebuilding its own titanium hull and its engines and its computers out of the raw ocean water around it, all while it's actively moving.
Right, it's a dynamic process.
Yeah. So if you look at the submarine on a Tuesday and then look at it again on a Friday, it might not share a single physical atom in common.
But the submarine is still a submarine.
Exactly. The organization remains intact.
What's fascinating here is that your submarine analogy perfectly captures the operational side of it, But to push it even closer to actual biology, think of it more like a whirlpool in a
It's
river.
a whirlpool. Okay.
Yeah, the water is rushing through it at incredible speed, completely replacing the physical material of the whirlpool every single millisecond. But the shape, the organization of the whirlpool
Oh,
persists.
wow. That makes a lot of sense.
And this introduces a really vital dynamic. Living things require both operational closure and material openness.
Okay, let me make sure I've got this. Operational closure means the loop of self-creation is like a closed circuit. The cell is the only thing making the cell.
Correct.
But material openness means it desperately needs to interact with the outside world. If it's completely closed off materially, it starves. If it's too open, its boundary just dissolves into a puddle.
Precisely that balance. It only survives by selectively taking in nutrients, expelling waste, and responding to energy flows.
Right.
But here's the critical shift in thinking that the paper points out. The environment doesn't instruct the cell what to do.
Wait, what do you mean?
The environment simply perturbs the cell. The cell's own internal structure, its autopoietic organization, determines how it will respond to that perturbation.
Okay, let's make this super concrete so we can really picture it. The paper uses the example of E. coli bacteria.
Yes, which is great because it strips away all human bias.
Exactly. No consciousness, no language, just a microscopic cell in your gut.
Right.
And the paper discusses this process called chemotaxis,
Right.
which is basically how the bacteria manages to swim toward food, like glucose, or away from acid. How does it actually do that?
Well, the mechanism of chemotaxis is fascinating. E. coli has these tiny whip-like tails called flagella.
The little tails, yeah.
Yeah, and when they rotate one way, the bacteria swings in a straight line. When they rotate the other way, the bacteria randomly tumbles around and points in a new direction.
But it doesn't have eyes.
No eyes, no brain. What it does is it measures the chemical concentration of its environment, moves forward, and then measures it again.
So it's comparing the present to the past.
Exactly. It compares its present state to its state a fraction of a second ago. It's a minimal form of temporality.
Oh, wow.
So if the glucose is increasing, it keeps swimming straight. If it's decreasing, it tumbles to change direction.
Okay, but wait, I have to ask the obvious question here.
Right?
Is the bacteria actually thinking? Like, does it know where the food is?
No, and the paper completely rejects that idea. And in doing so, it actually redefines cognition for us.
How so?
Well, cognition isn't knowing where the food is through some mental map or an internal representation of the outside world. That's a deeply human-centric, almost computer science way of looking at it.
Right, we always want to map things to a hard drive.
Exactly. But at this biological baseline, cognition is defined simply as adequate conduct in the conservation of living.
Adequate conduct, meaning if the organism just does the specific thing that keeps its autopoietic loop going, it's exhibiting cognition.
Yes. The environment triggers a change, but the organism specifies its own response based on its structure.
Okay.
And this dynamic introduces an incredibly important concept into our conceptual ladder, structural coupling.
Let's define that because that term, it comes up constantly in this framework. What exactly is structural coupling?
Think of a foot in a shoe.
All right.
When you buy a stiff pair of leather boots, they don't fit perfectly at first. But as you walk, the structure of your foot slightly changes the structure of the leather.
Oh, breaking them in.
Right. And the stiff leather slightly changes the calluses and shape of your foot. Over time, through a continuous interaction, they mold to each other. They become structurally coupled.
So in biology, the organism and its environment are constantly triggering structural changes in each other.
Yes, without destroying each other. The E. coli is structurally coupled to the gut. They fit together. And because they fit together, things in that environment take on what the paper calls valenced sensoriality.
Valence sensoriality, meaning that for this single cell, the stuff around it has a positive or negative charge, a meaning.
Exactly. E. coli doesn't have emotions as we understand them. It doesn't feel joy when it finds glucose.
Right, no tiny bacterial smiles.
No, but things absolutely matter to it. Differences in the chemical gradient make a viability difference. It has to decide, do I incorporate this molecule or expel it?
Do I swim toward it or tumble away?
Yes. And this choice is the absolute microscopic root of what will eventually become human emotion and value. Long before there are brains to process language, there is a cell deciding whether an interaction preserves its life or destroys it.
That is just wild to think about. I mean, Meaning doesn't start with poetry or philosophy. It starts with a bacterium deciding if a molecule is useful for its continued self-creation.
That is the beginning of meaning, yes.
Okay, so if we take this basic rule, this desperate effort to maintain a coherent self in a chaotic environment, and we scale it up, we take a staggering leap from the single cell to the human body.
A massive leap.
Right, because we're talking about going from one autopoietic unit to trillions of them functioning together.
Yeah.
How do trillions of cells coordinate without just, I don't know, eating each other and destroying the whole system?
Well, that is the grand problem of multicellularity. The paper argues that the human body isn't just a machine made of separate plumbing and electrical systems. It's a nested coherence.
A nested coherence. Like Russian nesting dolls.
Very much like that. You have cells living within tissues, tissues within organs, organs within a body. And each level provides a local environment, a local niche, for the living elements inside it.
Okay, let's unpack this because it's so important. The organism has this incredibly difficult job, right? It has to keep all these individual cells alive, but it has to prioritize the global coherence of the whole body.
Yes, sometimes it even requires programmed cell death according to what the whole body needs.
Which brings into sharp focus the terrifying breakdown of that nested coherence. Cancer.
Oh, absolutely.
The paper uses cancer as the ultimate example of a defection from this biological agreement. Because the cancer cells are very much alive, right?
Highly alive. They're adapting, metabolizing, reproducing rapidly.
But they're optimizing only for their local viability. They are solely focused on their own immediate growth, and they end up destroying the global coherence of the organism they live inside.
It's an incredibly potent biological lesson about the extreme dangers of unchecked local success. The cancer cell is highly successful at being a cancer cell.
Right. It forces the body to build new blood vessels just for it.
Yes. Angiogenesis. It evades the immune system. But its success is pathologically disconnected from the life capacity of the whole. If the tumor wins, the host dies, and the tumor dies with it.
You know, when I read that section, my mind just immediately mapped this onto the global economy.
The parallel is unavoidable.
It really is. It's a terrifyingly perfect analogy for profit-maximizing corporations that operate without any regard for the environment. I mean, a corporation can be incredibly successful by its own local metrics.
It grows its quarterly revenue, builds massive infrastructure.
Exactly. Yeah. It lobbies to evade regulations, just like a tumor evading the immune system. But if it achieves that growth by destroying the biosphere, it's acting exactly like a cancer cell.
Optimizing for local viability while destroying the global coherence of the planet.
Right. So mere survival or growth is an insufficient metric for health. And viewing the body through this lens completely changes how we should look at human health and medicine.
It does. The paper suggests we desperately need to shift medicine away from what it calls a war model to a harmony model.
The war model being basically the default language of modern medicine, like how we all talk about sickness. You fight a cold, you battle cancer.
Right. Doctors use magic bullets. The immune system is described as a military defense force.
But the paper argues the militaristic metaphor is fundamentally limited, right?
Yeah, because the body doesn't live by walling itself off and destroying everything foreign. If it did, fundamental processes like digestion or pregnancy or our entire microbiome would be completely impossible.
We require selective openness.
Exactly. So the paper proposes a harmony model where disease is not viewed simply as a hostile invasion. Rather, disease is a disharmonization. It's a loss of the organism's nested coherence.
The paper details this out really practically by outlining the five destinies of molecules. Mm. And honestly, this changed how I view my own metabolism.
Let's walk through them.
Yeah. So when any molecule enters the body, an apple, a breath of air, a pill, one of five things happens to it. First, it can be incorporated, used for cellular energy.
Second, it can be destroyed, like when the liver encounters a toxin and breaks its chemical bonds.
Third, it can be expelled, sweating, breathing out carbon dioxide. Fourth, it can be accumulated. The body doesn't know what to do with it, so it just stores it away, like fat or heavy metals.
And the crucial fifth destiny is disharmonizing.
Right.
This is a molecule that actively disrupts normal cellular processes. It interferes with that autopoietic loop we discussed.
So under this harmony model, The immune system isn't just a military force looking for things to kill.
No, it's an incredibly sophisticated boundary coherence intelligence. Its job is to constantly evaluate those five destinies for millions of molecules every single second.
It negotiates microbial coexistence, right? Like in our gut.
Exactly. It's constantly in dialogue with trillions of bacteria asking, does this interaction restore harmony or does it disrupt it?
Which completely reframes complex conditions like autoimmune diseases. Because under the war model, autoimmunity is just explained as friendly fire.
Right. The immune system supposedly gets confused and starts shooting its own troops.
But the harmony model offers a much deeper explanation. It describes autoimmunity not as a stupid mistake, but as a conserved disharmony.
Yes. The organism is trapped in an unresolved regulatory loop, usually because the body remains structurally coupled to a niche, an environment that keeps triggering a disturbance.
A trigger like chronic psychological stress or environmental toxins.
Or inflammatory diets. The immune system is desperately trying to restore coherence, but the perturbation never stops.
So it gets stuck in chronic inflammation.
Exactly. The body isn't attacking itself maliciously. It's caught in an infinite loop of trying to heal a wound that the environment keeps tearing open.
Just imagine applying this to your own life. Instead of viewing your body as a mechanical vehicle with broken parts, you view yourself as a dynamic organism trying to negotiate harmony in a specific niche.
And your niche is everything.
Right. It's the ultra-processed food you eat, the chronic cortisol spikes at work, the blue light from your screens at midnight. If you're chronically sick, your body might not be malfunctioning at all.
It might be perfectly, logically adapting to a deeply toxic environment. Health promotion becomes about life-coherent niche design, not just pills.
Okay, so if our bodies are essentially these complex, nested coherences of bacterial-like cells, what makes us distinctly human?
That's the big leap.
Right, because we don't just swim toward glucose in a petri dish. We build civilizations. We engage in abstract philosophy. And the paper asserts that this human leap happens through two foundational capacities, languaging and emotioning.
Let's dive into languaging first, because it completely shatters how we usually think about communication. The paper insists that language is not information transfer.
Wait, really? It's not information transfer?
No. We traditionally think of communication like a pipeline, right? I have a fully formed thought, I encode it into words, send it through sound waves, and your brain decodes it.
Right, like I'm handing you a USB drive of data.
Exactly. But biologically, this is impossible. Remember, operational closure from the cell.
Yes, the closed loop.
You cannot insert information into a closed system from the outside. The nervous system is operationally closed. Therefore, language cannot be the transmission of independent data.
Okay, so what is it then?
Language is defined as the recursive coordination of actions, feelings, and relations.
Okay, I think of this like dancing.
That's a perfect analogy.
Right. When you and I are ballroom dancing, and I step forward, I'm not transmitting a discrete data packet into your brain commanding step backward.
No, you're initiating a physical perturbation.
Yeah, and you step backward because of your own internal structure, your training, your balance, your history of dancing with me.
Exactly. When I say a word to you, I am not giving you meaning. I am inviting you into a dance step, and you respond based on your entire history of living.
So words aren't containers carrying meaning at all?
No, words are nodes in relational networks. The meaning is the history of coordination we share around that word.
Which perfectly explains why human misunderstanding is just so common.
Right. It's not just static on the line. Misunderstandings are biologically inevitable because we all have different histories of structural coupling.
Different life experiences. So when a word perturbs us, our internal structure triggers a slightly different dance.
Precisely. And this seamlessly sets up the second half of the human leap, emotioning.
And here, the paper completely flips traditional Western philosophy on its head. For centuries, we've been taught that logic and reason are the highest human faculties, and emotions are just these messy, irrational disturbances.
But the paper states the exact opposite. Emotions are the very foundation of reason.
A foundation? Wow.
It forces us to completely reevaluate how we debate. The paper defines emotions as bodily dispositions that open and close domains of possible action.
Give me an example of that.
Think about fear. Fear isn't just a feeling in your stomach. It physically dilates your pupils, changes your heart rate, and biologically narrows your perception to focus only on threats.
It closes off the possibility of curiosity or collaboration.
Exactly. Whereas trust is a bodily disposition that opens up vulnerability and learning. And here's the kicker. Our prized, flawless logic always operates within the domain established by the underlying emotion.
So, if you and I are debating the economy, and my baseline emotion is fear and scarcity, but yours is trust and abundance, we will literally never agree.
Never.
My logic might be perfect, your logic might be perfect, but we are building our logic on different premises.
Mm.
My fear selects the premise that we must hoard. Your trust selects the premise that we can share.
The emotion has already solved the equation before the logic even starts. This is why throwing facts and spreadsheets at someone rarely changes their mind.
If a society is operating in terror, it literally cannot reason its way into peace.
Exactly. Which brings us to the profound title of the paper, The Biology of Love.
Yes, and we have to be incredibly precise here. When you say love today, people think of weddings and pop songs. But Dr. Saholi defines it with strict biological precision.
Yes. In this framework, love is defined as the relational domain in which the other appears as a legitimate other in coexistence.
The other appears as a legitimate other in coexistence. It's so powerful. It means I am not trying to change you. I'm not trying to use you. I'm just allowing you to exist alongside me, fully valid.
And understanding the inverse is just as critical. Lovelessness, in this biological sense, results in epistemic narrowing.
Epistemic narrowing, it literally makes you blind.
It does. When you operate without love, from fear or greed, you become biologically incapable of accurately perceiving the full reality of the other.
This is the most staggering part for me. Love isn't just an ethical choice to be a nice person. It is a fundamental requirement for accurate science and perception.
Yes.
If a corporate executive looks at an ancient forest without love, they experience epistemic narrowing. They literally cannot see the fungal networks or the oxygen production. They only see timber.
They are functionally blind.
Or if a burnout teacher looks at a child without love, they don't see a developing mind. They just see a test score.
That is the core revelation here. Love expands perception. Lovelessness reduces reality to flat objects of consumption. So a life-coherent civilization isn't just morally superior, it is epistemologically accurate.
Wow. Okay, so we've climbed from the cell to the body to language and emotion. Once we have language and emotion, we start building communities. But how do we sustain them over generations?
Well, the paper introduces a fascinating comparative biology concept. Think about social insects, like ants.
Okay.
They coordinate massive colonies through a process called trophallaxis.
Which is what, exactly?
It's the continuous physical exchange of regurgitated food, hormones, and chemical signals between the ants. It creates a shared, literal, biological metabolism for the colony.
Right, but humans obviously don't go around swapping stomach contents to build cities. So what's our equivalent?
For human beings, the binding force is logolaxis.
Logolaxis.
Yes. It is the continuous, recursive flow of networks of conversations,
yeah.
The conversational metabolism of a culture. We coordinate society through exchanging stories, laws, jokes, norms.
Logolaxis is the invisible web holding us together. But wait, hold on. I'm struggling with this a bit.
What's the sticking point?
If logolaxis is simply how humans coordinate action, then isn't any coordinated group of humans a functional social system? Like a multinational corporation is coordinated, a maximum security prison is coordinated. Are those social systems?
The author draws a very sharp distinction here that challenges our vocabulary. The paper argues we deeply misuse the word social. Coordination is not sociality.
How can a coordinated group of people not be social?
Because you can have a highly efficient system that is fundamentally antisocial in its biology. If a system relies on fear, domination, or coercion, like a sweatshop or a punitive corporate office, it is an antisocial coordination.
It gets the job done, but it degrades the people inside it.
Exactly. True sociality, in this strict biological framework, only exists where mutual care and the legitimacy of the other are actively conserved.
That is deeply unsettling, because it implies we've built an entire modern world that is hyper-coordinated global banking, massive hierarchies, but much of it is completely devoid of true sociality.
It operates on fear and competition, and the paper asks, how do we reproduce this antisocial coordination generation after generation?
Through our education system.
Yes, our reproductive system for culture.
The section on education hit me so hard. The paper makes the point that children don't just learn subjects. They don't just sit there and absorb math. Pupils learn teachers.
Yes. They are learning how to live with the adults who are teaching them. The classroom is a relational niche.
And if that classroom is organized around distrust, meaning the system doesn't trust that students actually want to learn, that Distrust necessitates control.
Right. The teacher must force them to learn.
And control leads to forced obedience, which generates fear, which destroys a child's self-respect.
Leading to a lifelong psychological dependence on external authority figures.
And the paper makes this razor-sharp distinction between self-esteem and self-respect. I had always used those interchangeably.
Most people do. But self-esteem is evaluative. It's comparative. It's based on winning or being better than someone else.
It's incredibly fragile. The moment you fail, your self-esteem crashes.
But self-respect is a baseline emotion. It's the unshakable feeling of your own legitimacy as a human being, regardless of whether you win or lose.
And an education system built entirely on standardized testing might produce high self-esteem in the winners, but it systematically destroys self-respect across the board.
Even in the high achievers, because their worth becomes conditional.
But the author introduces this beautiful pedagogical shift, specifically regarding how we handle mistakes. In a control-based system, a wrong answer is a moral failure.
A defect to be punished.
Right. But in a life-coherent system, a mistake is viewed simply as a domain crossing.
Let's break that down. A domain crossing means the student isn't stupid. They are just operating using a different internal logic than the teacher.
Like, imagine a young child is asked what 2 plus 2 is, and they answer 22.
In a punitive system, they get a red X.
But in a life-coherent system, the teacher recognizes the child put the two numbers next to each other visually. They crossed into a different domain.
The teacher's job isn't to humiliate them. It's to act with love, to explore the logic of the student's domain and gently guide them.
Imagine a society where every corporate manager, every parent, looked at someone doing something wrong and asked, "What is the internal logic of the domain you are operating in?"
It would completely change conflict resolution.
But we don't just live in isolated classrooms anymore. Our local access has scaled up through the internet to encompass the entire planet. Which brings us to the top of our ladder, the homosphere and planetary pathology.
Yes. At this scale, there is no longer a pristine nature separate from human society. We live in a biosphere-anthroposphere unity.
The anthroposphere being our built world of concrete, networks, and economies.
And it has grown so massive that it is now the primary niche maker for the entire planet. We live in the homosphere, an Earth completely transformed by human local axis.
And right now, the vital signs of that homosphere are crashing. The paper integrates the work of philosopher John McMurtry, who coined the concept of the life ground.
The life ground is basically all the natural and social conditions required for any life to thrive. Clean water, breathable air, social belonging.
But our global operating system has replaced the life ground with a money value system. We literally place a higher value on abstract digital numbers in a bank than on the living ecosystems that sustain us.
And this systemic inversion brings in the sociologist Johann Galtung and his three types of violence. When we hear the word violence, we think of direct physical harm.
A punch in the face, a military invasion, direct violence.
But there are two far more pervasive forms. Structural violence is harm built into the architecture of society.
Like poverty or urban food deserts.
Exactly. Because it predictably reduces the life capacity of the people living within those structures. It operates exactly like the disharmonizing niche we talked about earlier. The structure itself is the toxin.
And the third type, which holds it all together, is cultural violence. This is the local axis we discussed, the prevailing narratives, the media framing that justifies the structural violence.
The cultural belief that poor people are just lazy or that clear-cutting a rainforest is just the acceptable cost of economic progress.
This blew my mind. The planetary crisis we're facing, climate change, mass extinction, isn't just a technical glitch. It is an epistemological and emotional failure.
We are suffering from a cultural violence that makes corporate profit highly visible, but makes the destruction of the life ground completely invisible.
It is epistemic narrowing on a planetary scale.
Which is why the paper points to interventions like the Earth Charter. It's not just a list of polite environmental suggestions. It's a deliberate intervention in our global local axis.
It's an attempt to rewrite the conversation. It invites humanity to fundamentally expand its sense of locality.
I found that concept so challenging but necessary. Your locality expands with your understanding. Usually we think of our local community just as our physical neighborhood.
Right. But if you deeply understand that the lithium in your smartphone battery was mined by exploited workers in another hemisphere, and the carbon emissions from shipping it are sinking an island nation.
Suddenly, that mine and that island are in your ethical locality. Because you understand the consequence, you are now structurally coupled to it.
Radius of care has to expand to match your radius of understanding.
It's a tremendously heavy burden. We are the first species capable of conscious planetary niche-making.
Which means we are forced to develop planetary responsibility. But man, the diagnosis we've laid out is heavy. We have antisocial coordination destroying the life ground.
Fueled by cultural violence, yes.
So how do we actually change this without just using more control? How do we avoid becoming, like, authoritarian environmental dictators?
That is the ultimate question. It brings us to the final section, the antidote. Tao, Wu Wei, and metanoia.
Let's start with metanoia. It sounds like a sci-fi concept, but it's deeply ancient.
It's a Greek term implying a fundamental, radical shift in how you see the world. Moving away from objectivist certainty, the arrogant belief that you possess the absolute truth, toward reflective participation.
The humbling realization that we aren't passive observers watching a pre-given world. We are actively bringing forth the world every day through our conversations and emotions.
Metanoia is the internal shift from control to trust, from domination to love. And crucially, you cannot force metanoia onto someone else.
It only happens through honest self-reflection. And this ties directly into the biological interpretation of the Tao. The Tao is often presented as this mystical, magical way of the universe.
But Dr. Saheli frames it as a grounded biological reality. It's the practice of living fully in the present language without becoming alienated by our expectations. It's about detachment.
And we should clarify, detachment isn't coldness or apathy. It's letting go of false transcendences.
Letting go of the delusion of infinite economic growth on a finite planet. Letting go of the ego-driven need for permanent control over others.
When you let go of the rigid demand that the world conform perfectly to your abstract theories, true responsive care can finally emerge. You stop trying to force the river, and you navigate the actual current.
Exactly.
But I kept asking myself, what does this actually look like in practice? How do we do this? The paper uses the ancient Chinese concept of Wu Wei. Non-forcing action.
Effortless action.
I was trying to wrap my head around this, and I keep coming back to the difference between a mechanic fixing a car and a gardener cultivating a garden.
Oh, that's perfect.
If a car engine is broken, the mechanic relies entirely on forcing parts into place. Rip it out, bolt a new one in, tighten it with a wrench. It's domination, force, and linear control.
Because the mechanic is acting upon a dead, allopoetic machine.
Exactly. But a gardener is dealing with living, autopoietic systems. A gardener cannot force a tomato plant to grow. You can't take a wrench to a vine.
No, the gardener's job is entirely about managing the conditions, the soil, the water, the sunlight. You remove the weeds, provide nutrients, and step back.
You allow the plant to reorganize its own autopoietic growth. You act on the conditions, not the object.
And that distinction is the pure essence of Wu Wei. It's action through the cultivation of conditions, not domination through direct command. And we can apply this to every level of our ladder.
Like in medicine, the doctor isn't a mechanic fighting a violent war. The doctor is a gardener supporting the body's natural healing margins.
Creating the physiological conditions where harmony can restore itself. And in education, the teacher isn't forcing compliance. The teacher is cultivating a relational niche of trust where curiosity flourishes.
And in planetary governance, we stop trying to geoengineer nature with brute force and start aggressively restoring the ecological conditions where the biosphere can heal itself.
It leads to the golden rule of transformation in this entire paper. When you are trying to change a toxic workplace or a failing global system, do not focus purely on what you want to destroy.
Focus fiercely on what must be conserved.
Yes. Because if your entire movement is focused only on destroying the opposition, you remain trapped in the antisocial domain of war and control. You're just fighting for dominance.
But if you shift your focus to what must be conserved, the innate dignity of a child, the cleanliness of a watershed, mutual respect, and you fiercely protect those conditions,
the rest of the system will naturally have to reorganize around it. The central attractor shifts from power and profit to life capacity.
Wow. This has been a monumental climb. Let's try to distill this massive journey. From the very beginning, life is the recursive conservation of viable coherence.
From a single microscopic cell maintaining its boundary in the ocean.
To a human body balancing the harmony of trillions of parts. To human beings using language and emotion to coordinate realities. All the way up to the logalaxis of our global culture.
The ultimate diagnostic tool for everything we do must always be, does this action preserve, restore, and expand life capacity?
And if the honest answer is no, it doesn't matter how efficient or profitable the system appears to be, it is ultimately pathological. It is coordination without care.
And it will eventually collapse the life ground it depends on.
I want to bring this massive planetary theory right back down to you, the listener. Look at your own daily reality, your workplace, your family dynamics, your local community. What is your logalaxis?
What are the recurring conversations you are participating in every single day?
Are they rooted in control, fear, forced obedience, and constant ranking? Or are they rooted in trust, mutual respect, and love, the genuine practice of allowing others to be legitimate?
In your daily actions, are you operating as a mechanic trying to force parts into place with a wrench? Or are you acting as a gardener tending to the conditions of your environment?
It requires deep, uncomfortable self-reflection. Because if metanoia is real, if we are the ones constantly bringing forth the world through our language and emotions, then we are entirely responsible for the world we leave behind.
We are the niche makers.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought that builds on everything we've unpacked today. We learned that our physical bodies are structurally coupled to our environmental niches.
And that our immune systems constantly respond to our emotional environment.
Yeah, right. But for billions of us, our primary waking niche is now overwhelmingly digital. We spend hours every single day immersed in the hyper-fast, algorithmically driven logalaxis of social media.
A conversational metabolism that is explicitly designed by corporations to trigger outrage and fear just to keep us scrolling.
Exactly. If that is our dominant environment, how is that digital niche literally rewriting our cellular and immune coherence? If our logalaxis trains our biology, are we physiologically evolving to become incompatible with peace?
That may be the defining question of the homosphere in the 21st century. If the medium is the metabolism, we must fiercely guard the conversations we are ingesting, because they are literally becoming our biology.
Think about that. The next time you feel that spike of stress, that narrowing of perception, while staring at a glowing screen, we are swimming in deeply disharmonizing waters, but we possess the capacity to choose a different coherence. Thank you so much for taking this incredibly deep, demanding journey with us today. Keep questioning the systems around you, keep learning, and above all, keep expanding your radius of care. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.